In this installment of On Topic, Baylor University President Ken Starr talks with Frank Wolf. Frank Wolf is the Jerry and Susie Wilson Chair in Religious Freedom at Baylor University. He's also served as the U.S. Representative for Virginia's 10th District for 17 terms and authored the International Religious Freedom Act. President Starr and Wolf talked about the state of religious freedom in the United States and abroad. The conversation took place on Wednesday, March 18th, 2015.
Welcome, Frank. Thank you. Dr. Baker, Lori, thank you. Thank you for your service to our students, to the world. And thank you for your service as chair of the Faculty Senate. As I look out over the audience, we have so many wonderful and distinguished friends. It's always dangerous to recognize anyone. We have judges and other public officials, members of the City Council. But I would be remiss if I did not ask our mayor to stand and be recognized. Malcolm Duncan. We also have a friend of freedom here whose story is very powerful. He deserves his own time here as an on-topic guest, and he's a fairly frequent, not frequent enough, visitor to Baylor University. He survived Tiananmen Square. He was a student leader in Beijing and went on to become a great friend of freedom, converted, became a believer after the Tiananmen Square massacre, and is now safely in the United States and head of a wonderful Christian human rights organization. Bob Fu, would you stand and be recognized? Our wonderful Baylor bookstore has Bob's book on sale, and it is, I have read it as well as this wonderful book, Prisoner of Conscience, and we'll be talking about this. This is Frank's, essentially his professional autobiography, and the story just unfolds as to how someone who could have gone on what are pejoratively called congressional junkets, and instead, Frank was always out and about in refugee camps. He brought the nation's attention to a famine in Ethiopia when the world was averting its gaze, but he went there and went among the suffering and came back and convinced the Congress and the administration that we as people of conscience cannot allow precious little children and adults to face mass starvation, and that's just the kind of person he is. He is a prisoner of conscience, and he's ours. You're our prisoner now, Frank, because he's holding the. But it's community service because he is holding the Jerry and Susie Wilson Chair in religious freedom. We promised him he would not have to grade papers and blue books and all that, but to really be a source of encouragement for us, but especially for our students. And he was interacting with our students today. He's been on campus this week, and we're thankful for that. And we will be seeing Frank each semester, Lord willing, as well as his wonderful partner in life and spouse. And Carolyn, would you please stand and be recognized? Carolyn Wolf. You know, Dr. Baker mentioned that Frank is a Philadelphian, and if you are in Philadelphia, how can you but love our country and love the history of our country? And he steeped himself as a youngster in biographies of the founding generation and others, and so how appropriate it is that he felt this call to public service. He could have become, because I knew him when, a very wealthy lobbyist. He was a very successful young lobbyist in Washington, D.C., but he felt the call to serve. He had served on the staff of a member of Congress from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He served in an important position at the Department of Interior. He was in private practice. I remember you had Gerber Foods as one of your clients. I thought that's pretty cool, and we'll have babies, and we know Frank Wolf, and we'll all be good, get some free baby food. But in any event, he was willing to take a real chance because he felt the calling, and I hope he'll talk about that. But he ran once for the House of Representatives. He did not succeed. He ran a second time for the House of Representatives. He did not succeed. But three's a charm, and the rest is all history. And so many of us were not surprised, but we were disappointed when Frank said that he was going to lay his burdens down. But knowing Frank, as Allison and I do, we knew he was not going to retire to the golf course or to a life of leisure. And now he has freedom to work on behalf of the cause of freedom. So he is a great American, a great patriot. And when Chuck Colson said in his tribute to Frank that he is the conscience of the House of Representatives, I think that's something that, well, you can be very proud of. So you can see why we're so proud and thankful. We're deeply, deeply grateful to Frank for being willing to join with us. He also has another capacity. He's a senior fellow of the newly formed 21st Century Wilberforce Institute. And it was really in that, based in Washington, D.C., actually in Northern Virginia. And it was actually in that capacity that Frank went just weeks ago. In fact, we were with him to announce the chair, Jerry and Susie Wilson's home in Dallas. And the announcement he made then and accepting the chair and greeting so many of our Baylor Bears in Dallas was that he was leaving in a matter of hours for Turkey and Iraq. And what he and his colleagues did was to hear the story of the persecution that is so unthinkable and unspeakable at the hands of ISIS. Frank, why don't we begin by your telling us about the trip, what you saw, what you heard, and then what you think we should do.
Well, thank you, Ken. Thank you very much. Everyone's been very hospitable, so I'm, you know, pleased to be here. But thank you for the friendship and the warmth that my wife and I have felt. It was a trip that we wanted to take, as many of you know, particularly those who know the Bible well. More biblical activity took place in Iraq than any other country of the world, other than Israel. Abraham is from Ur, which is modern-day Nasiriya. Rebecca lived in Iraq. The 12 tribes of Israel were from Iraq. Ezekiel's buried in Iraq. Jonah, Nineveh, ISIS just blew up Jonah's tomb about 4 months ago. Daniel is buried in Iraq. The book of Esther for such a time like this is from Iraq. And so we went and we spent most of the time with Iraqi Christians. They were called Assyrian Chaldean Christians and also Yazidis. The stories are horrendous. They've been moved from village to village and forced out of Mosul. Mosul has been taken over. Mosul is Nineveh in the Bible, the Nineveh Plains. We also met with a number of Yazidis, young girls, who told us they had been kidnapped by ISIS and taken away, and two had escaped, but what took place to them is very, very brutal. We went out with Peshmerga, the military. We went up to look at the front lines with regard to ISIS. They told us that many of the people who are fighting for ISIS are foreign fighters. There are roughly 20 or more thousand who have come from around the world. There are up to 150 to 160, maybe 170 from the United States that have left. You may have seen the article in today's paper about the Air Force veteran who they just arrested who wanted to go. And the atrocities are taking place day in and day out. The one constant comment from all of them, particularly from the Christian community, was, does the church in the West care? They feel a sense of abandonment. Jesus has many comments in the Bible with regard to have come from Luke, you know, to set the captive free and freedom. And there's so many other passages, Old and New Testament, Ecclesiastes 4:1, I saw all the impression under the sun. And so they wonder, does the West care? Is this a burden that the West has? And they have really not seen that. We are going to see perhaps the end of Christianity in that region. Perhaps in Syria, it may almost be over. But in 2003, there were 1.5 million Christians in Iraq. Most of them speak Assyrian Chaldean. The Syrian Chaldeans speak Aramaic, which is the language of Jesus. In fact, we stayed with the Dominican sisters who sang the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic, and they just can't understand. They're now down to 250,000, and 12 Iraqi families leave that region every day. When ISIS came in, they were told either to convert, to pay a tax, or to leave, or they were going to be killed. And one man, cancer has been in my family. My mom died of cancer. My father died of cancer. We've been impacted in my own family with cancer. And one man told a story. ISIS came into his village, took over, then took over Mosul. His wife had breast cancer. He took his wife to the hospital for the regular treatment. And ISIS and the people of the hospital said, we will not give your wife treatment unless she converts and unless you convert. And the story, it's in my report, he refused to convert. Obviously, his wife refused to convert. She died of cancer. He has a boy now living in San Diego, a daughter in a refugee camp in Turkey, and two little boys with him. So the ultimate question they ask is, have we been abandoned? Does the Christian church in the West really care about us?
This is the report. It's available online. The report from the Wilberforce Initiative is The Edge of Extinction, the Eradication of Religious and Ethnic Minorities in Iraq. And obviously our heart goes out to our Christian brothers and sisters, but there are other religious minorities who are likewise suffering persecution.
Yazidis. The Yazidis have actually suffered worse than the Christians. The Turkmen have also suffered. So it isn't just Christian. It's Christian, Yazidi, Turkmen, and some other religious minorities. And one of the recommendations, and the Kurdish government is willing to do it, is to set up a protectorate, a region whereby the Christians, the Yazidis, the Turkmens, can be. They're asking for help from our government to establish a National Guard unit. There's what the NPU, we visited their training camp. Some of them are 45 and 50-year-old men who have come to protect their villages, but they cannot get assistance from our government. And our government, in spite of the law that passed last year with the Senator Levin Amendment, our government will not give direct aid to the Peshmerga, who is fighting ISIS. In order for them to get any aid, it goes from us to Baghdad. Baghdad is controlled by the Shia, and the Iranians are all over Baghdad. And so the Iranians almost have a check on whether or not the goods come in. So in essence, Peshmerga, which has lost over 1,000, they get very little aid. And the Kurdistan government said they will set up a protectorate, but they're asking for equipment. They're not asking for men on the ground. They're asking for equipment, and they're asking for training. And yet our government has not been motivated to help.
Frank, what should we do?
Well, I think there's several things you can do. One, I think you can pray. Many people believe, and I do, that I think the end of communism came about because millions of people, I remember as a little boy, I was told by my parents to pray for the end of communism, and I believe that prayer, using obviously the Pope and President Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, did a tremendous effort. Secondly, I think we should encourage that there be a war crimes investigation by the UN. This is genocide. It actually meets the definition of Raphael Lemkin of the genocide. It's the cleansing of a particular ethnic or religious group. Thirdly, we should urge our government, both the Congress, but particularly the administration, to aid the Peshmerga, who is the point of the spear against ISIS. And lastly, as we give weapons and aid to the Kurdistan government, to Peshmerga, we should insist that they do two things. Set up the protectorate, whereby the Christians and the Yazidis and the Turkmen can come together. And secondly, that they give reparations, because many of them said, we lost our house in Mosul. They're even getting telephone calls. As strange as this may sound, some of them are getting telephone calls from ISIS-type people who have taken over their house. And they're asking them questions about, where is this in the house? And what is this in the house? It's kind of bizarre, but they think many of their things have been taken. They had a few hours to get out. They're asking for reparations, whereby they can restart their life, because they believe they can never go back to that area. So there's a lot that the United States government, we can.
So should we write our member of Congress? Should we write? What should we do specifically in addition to pray?
Well, I think we should write our members of Congress. I think we should write the administration. I think, and I don't want to get too political here, but I think we need the passage of authorization of the use of military force. ISIS is connected to Boko Haram. Boko Haram in Nigeria just pledged a week ago their support, and Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, has accepted the support. They are also connected. ISIS is now in Libya, and they were the ones who beheaded the 21 Coptic Christians. And interesting enough, those Coptic Christians never screamed, they never hollered, they never said anything. I don't know how, I mean, if you can imagine how you could, you know, but because of their faith in the people, the people there. Also, they're connected to a group called Al-Shabaab, which is in Somalia, which is threatening to blow up shopping malls. They were the ones who threatened the mall of America. They're now in Afghanistan. They're now in parts of Egypt. So we need to not only just say ISIS, but there needs to be an effort, and not only in a military. We need to win, to almost do what the Reagan administration, and in fairness, the Carter administration and the Kennedy administration, the fight against communism wasn't weapons, it was ideas. You remember Radio Free Europe and different things like this. But we, if the United States doesn't fail to provide the leadership, then it's not gonna happen. And as of now, we are not winning the war. The last comment I'll make about ISIS, go online and read the article, March 2015, Atlantic Monthly, by a guy named Graham Woods. When you finish your article, you will be frightened. And so America has to provide the leadership.
By the way, this article that the congressman is referring to is getting an enormous amount of attention. It is an article deeply within the mainstream media. That is, I'm just going to go ahead and say it, saying the ISIS worldview is deeply seated in a particular religious worldview. Yeah. So I won't characterize it further. Obviously, we hope and pray for the best of people of all faiths, people of goodwill. But it is, as we say in the law, a clear and present danger in so much of the world. Obviously, we're not immune. We always are aware of the possibility of some horrific attack here in the United States. So we're by no means insulated. The Boston Marathon situation reminded us of that. So we need to inform ourselves, to be in prayer, and then to urge our government. That's one of the things the First Amendment protects, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. You say, well, the government won't listen. You might be surprised. Does the government listen to the people?
Absolutely, it does. I think if you talk to any congressional office, if they get 10, 15, 20 letters on a particular issue, they listen. If they get a telephone call, they listen. They do listen. I think sometimes the emails have less power, but if somebody writes a letter, calls, because we in Congress work for you. It's public servants, so yes, they will listen. As of now, we're not really hearing that much from the American people. And as Judge Starr said, you have already been impacted by ISIS, by what's taking place, radical Islamic terrorism. Anwar Alawi, who is an imam from my congressional district, radicalized using the internet Major Hassan, who killed 13 people at Fort Hood, which is not very far from here, and wreaked havoc on their families. That was all done over the internet. ISIS has some of the most sophisticated technology. They have all the weapons. They have all American weapons. When the Iraqis left, they left their tanks. They left the Humvees. They left the guns. But they have sophisticated people, some who have said, who have worked in America on the internet. They have a very sophisticated internet. So this region, in some respects, with the radicalization of the major at Fort Hood who killed 13 people, this region, I don't know how close Fort Hood is here, but relatively close, yeah, has already in some respects been impacted.
That's a real word of encouragement. And I would just say, when I was in California, we had a member of the House of Representatives and from the other political party. And he said he follows the rule of eight on visits back to the district. If he hears, and he keeps count, but it's face-to-face town hall meetings or whatever. If I hear from eight people about an issue, I'm on it. Now, that's not that many. Out of how many constituents did you have?
700,000.
700. So the rule of eight. So we tend to, I think that no one cares, and we're just, but it's really not true. So you're hearing someone who served in the United States House of Representatives for 34 years saying that they are, in fact, listening. Let's turn to religious liberty. More generally, on the national security side, the threats to religious liberty around the world. I want to bring it now close to home, because Frank was a great defender of religious liberty, not only internationally, as one of the architects of the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998, but also of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. And maybe we'll have a webinar or something and provide more background on this. But listen to the name, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. This was an act that was meant to address issues arising out of Supreme Court decisions that kind of curbed religious freedom, but especially freedom of conscience. And so Congress responded. Somebody said, well, the Supreme Court has ruled, that's it, it's all over. But Congress responded, and Frank was one of the leaders of that very important effort to restore a particular vision and a very robust vision of religious liberty. Here was the statement, in part, of President Clinton, who signed this bill into law enthusiastically in November of 1993. That wasn't so long ago. Anyone here remember 1993? The importance of religious liberty. What a broad coalition. By the way, this is in the Rose Garden. You can find it on YouTube. I mean, he was not doing this in a corner. This is not some signing statement that someone drafted. Here he is. And you could tell that President Clinton was speaking from the heart. What a broad coalition of Americans came together to make this bill a reality. They worked together across ideological and religious lines. Some new friendships were formed, and new trust was established, which shows, I suppose, that the power of God is such that even in the legislative process, miracles can happen. Now, is that an amen? That was a really great moment, and I think all people of goodwill should familiarize themselves. You don't have to go to law school. It's a two-page law. Every citizen can understand what the Religious Freedom Restoration Act does. And it's the law of the land right now. It was a great moment, but it begs now the question, are we losing the great consensus that President Clinton spoke about on religious liberty? What's your view, Frank?
Well, I think to a certain degree we are, but I don't think it has to be that way. We are seeing, it would be preposterous to infer that we're similar to what's taking place in Iraq or places like that. No one's going to church, being arrested for going to a house church. No one's being arrested for giving Holy Communion. But have you looked at the Houston pastor's case, which shocked me coming from Houston? I never would expect that. You see,
these are the subpoenas for pastors'
notes.
The
subpoenas of the pastors. You see, InterVarsity has been removed from all of the college campuses in the California state system. They've been kicked off the Dartmouth campus. They've been kicked off Vanderbilt's campus. You see the fire commissioner in Atlanta losing the job. You're seeing certain things happening. I think you could put together a coalition. I think there are a number of Democrats who I think would support it. I think there is the opportunity in the current House and the current Senate to pass it. So I think there is the opportunity if it is approached in the right way. So yes, I think there has been a diminishing. There's been, I mean, you can feel it. You can, you know, we can't pretend that it's not happening, but I don't think it's inevitable. I think it can be reversed, and I think you can put it back together.
Well, one of the great examples of bipartisanship throughout Frank's service in Congress was with a liberal Democratic congressman named Tony Hall from Ohio. And Tony and Frank became very close friends. Their votes cancel one another out in most instances. But you've been very close friends. And how did that come about, and how can that happen now? It seems as if folks across the aisle, other than at Tuesday breakfast prayer gatherings, are not really in communion with one another.
Well, Tony and I joined a small group in 1982. There's a fellow named Doug Coe who ran the prayer breakfast, and he urged us to get together. And for the first 6 months, we had Republicans and Democrats, and it was a little stressful because you were never sure. I came from a marginal seat. I barely won when I won. And I didn't know if by saying this, Tony was going to take the word out to the Democratic Campaign Committee and say what I had said. So it didn't work well for the first. Then we just began to love each other. If you pray with someone, if you break bread with someone, the relationship becomes amazing. And Tony and I, my wife and his wife are very close friends. They're in a small group together. Tony has actually, and I was surprised there was never any punishment, Tony actually contributed to my campaign. I had a very tough race 1 year, and Tony wanted to write letters to the Democrats in my district telling us. But we began to love each other. We traveled with one another. We knew each other's families. We worked on issues together. And we would be in the chapel. We met at 4 o'clock on Tuesdays. The bells would ring. We would go in, and maybe Tony would vote green, and I would vote red, and we'd go back. But we really, we still meet. We're still friends. We just really care about one another. And the whole group was modeled after the Clapham Society, after what William Wilberforce did in the abolition of a slavery, but we care each other. We care. We like each other. We love each other.
Let me mention several other leaders, and you talk about them in this book. The book is available. You will be very sorry if you don't read this wonderful book. It's a great gift book, and I get no commission. I'm just trying to do my friends a favor. And at Prisoner of Conscience, and you were a very avid reader as a youngster, but there were stories that really stood out and have stood out for you. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, William Wilberforce, obviously in the 19th century, and others. What have you learned from these great, courageous people, and what lessons can we take from these wonderful examples?
Well, Wilberforce, I think he reached across the aisle, basically. He was more concerned about the issue than about the party, and he suffered a good bit. He not only did the slave trade, ended that, but he was with prison reform. And Chuck Colson really introduced me to Wilberforce. Chuck was a mentor. Whenever I'd have tough decisions, many times Sunday night, I called Chuck up. One of my daughters married a fellow that worked for Chuck for years. Chuck Colson combined the hard-headed reality. He's in the Nixon White House. It's pretty tough. He was a Marine, but the hard-headed reality with the softness of his faith in Christ. And so, but he introduced me to Wilberforce, and Wilberforce reached out and brought different groups in. Bonhoeffer, you may have read Eric Metaxas's book. Bonhoeffer literally gave his life, the Confessing Church. He stood up against Hitler 3 days before the end of the war. You could hear the shelling from the artillery from the West, and he was hung in Flossenbürg, a state prison. Another one, I'll tell you, a thing you ought to read is Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail. It is to the church. He expresses grave disappointment for the church for not, and so I think we may be reaching a point that some people may have to be willing, if you really care that much about it, to be willing to go to jail. But they were people of faith, and if you look at Dr. Brantley was a man of faith who fought Ebola and got Ebola. Chuck Colson, because of his faith, did prison reform. William Wilberforce, because of his faith, abolished the slave trade. Martin Luther King, because of his faith, came out against segregation. Mother Teresa, because of her faith, used to pick up poor people in Calcutta. So I think each and every one, but I think Wilberforce to reach out, and I think our country is divided. We should do everything we can. But Dietrich Bonhoeffer, not suggesting that people have to give their life, but I think Bonhoeffer paid the ultimate price.
The back of this book says, "What's a congressman from Virginia doing in places where bullets fly and babies starve?" Why were you in those places, Frank?
Tony called me in late November.
So this is Tony Hall.
Tony Hall. He had just gotten back from Ethiopia with Bill Emerson, who was also in our group. He was from Missouri. He's died of cancer.
And he was a representative from Missouri.
He was a representative of Missouri. And he said, "You got to go to Ethiopia." And so I said, okay. And what it triggered a thought, because I'd been campaigning in a division of motor vehicles. You know, there's always a crowd. And so if you're a politician, you go to DMV because they're there. And a young lady said to me, she said, "Have you been seeing what's going on?" This is in 1984, the famine in Ethiopia. I said, "I had." She said, "Would you go?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, but I'm not really thinking of it." Well, Tony called and said, "You should go." Seal Conte approved the trip. He wasn't sure why I wanted to go. I flew
from Massachusetts.
Yeah. Massachusetts. I flew off to Ethiopia, and that's when Mengistu was there with the Russian soldiers and the Cubans, and I couldn't get up to the famine area. And Blaine Harden, the fellow who wrote that, I think, saw me eating pizza.
It's a Washington Post reporter.
The Washington Post saw me eating pizza, and they have good pizza in Ethiopia, as you know. The Italians, well, the Italians used to.
Yeah.
Couldn't control you.
Yeah, Mussolini.
And so there was a devastating piece in the Post inferring that here there's famine and I'm eating pizza. And the next day, World Vision, I got in touch with World Vision, and they flew me up on the very plane. It was that the BBC camera crew had a twin otter, similar to the plane that Mickey Leyland from your state of Texas was on that crashed and killed. Mm. And I got up there, and we were in a camp run by World Vision, and Mother Teresa was on the other side. And at the end of the day, I said, "Can I stay?" The government said, "No, you shouldn't." This fellow from Ethiopia, Bob Latta, said, "If you stay, I'll stay." And an Ethiopian guy said, "You can sleep in my hut." And the plane couldn't make it back for a couple of days because of the weather. And that was a life-changing trip. in addition to the 1985 trip where Tony took me to Romania, where Ceausescu was bulldozing churches, but those two things sort of, and that's when the...
When you became prisoner of conscience.
Kind of. If you look at my newsletters in 81 and 82 and 83 and 84, they're all transportation. Mm. Metro, the airports, noise. And in 85, not that I didn't still work on transportation, but they changed. They changed because of the trip to Ethiopia that really Tony urged me to go on, and the trip to Romania that Tony took me on. Yeah, they were the things that changed.
Turning points.
Turning points.
By the way, the congressman mentioned the Al-Shabaab radical Islamic group in Somalia. That is the group that has essentially expelled us from Kenya. This wonderful group, and we have students who go on these magnificent mission trips, and we had such deep ties in Kenya, especially in Nairobi, but outside as well. We were deeply invested in East Africa with our love and care of our students and our faculty members in particular. But the State Department has wisely issued an advisory statement, and we cannot responsibly have our students on a Baylor-sponsored trip going to Kenya. So we feel so deeply sorrowful. We have had other open doors to us, in Zambia in particular. But there's an example of how radical Islam affects our students who develop those close friendships and relationships with precious young people and orphanages and so forth in Kenya.
And you know, a large number of Americans from Minneapolis have gone over to fight for Al-Shabaab, and there have been about 14 or 15 American citizens who have been killed fighting for Al-Shabaab. Mm. Americans.
Right here at home. By the way, we do have, as is customary at On Topic, opportunities to hear from you. We do ask you to write your questions on a card, and folks are coming up and down the aisle from time to time. At least I think that will happen if it hasn't already. Some questions I know are already in. So we're going to invite you to participate in the conversation as well. But just a couple of more questions, Frank, before we have our own town hall conversation here. And the first has to do with the International Religious Freedom Act. Now, circle back, Religious Freedom Restoration Act 1993, that was addressing Congress and the President addressing Supreme Court jurisprudence and saying, we do not think these anti-liberty restrictions should stand. Frank was a leader in that. As you focused on issues of international religious freedom, you were moved, and others, but Frank was an architect of the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998, and among other things, that International Religious Freedom Act created a new position, an ambassadorship, but instead of an ambassadorship to a country, an ambassador at large for religious freedom. Could you describe that, and what should we be doing in this day and time? Because I know that there are issues, there are current bills that are being introduced. One of them even bears the name in honor of Frank Wolf. The Frank Wolf bill has been introduced in the House of Representatives to continue to improve and enhance the effort by our country to support religious freedom internationally. So share with us your thoughts on why did the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998 come to be, the creation of the ambassadorship, which, by the way, went unfilled and has gone unfilled for much too long from time to time, but now Rabbi David Saperstein has been nominated and confirmed as of December, I think it was, by the United States Senate. So Rabbi Saperstein is now, and by the way, was involved in a program that Baylor and Georgetown were involved in 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C. So, Frank, reflections on that, and what lessons do we have today?
President Reagan said that the words in the Declaration of Independence and the words in the Constitution were a covenant, not only for the people in Philadelphia in 1776 and 1787, but a covenant with the entire world. Bob Fu, who I guess is still here,
yes,
can tell
Bob,
you there was a Statue of Freedom in Tiananmen modeled after the Statue of Liberty. And a covenant is deeper, stronger than a contract. And the people there knew, when you would go to Romania in 1985, they knew of the words. They knew of freedom. They knew that we, and so I think we have an obligation for that covenant. Secondly, when a country has religious freedom, we're not at war with them. They're generally a democracy. They're generally prosperous. Their people do well. And if you look today, and as Judge Starr said, that position for the 6 years of this administration, it was only filled for three of the 6 years. That means for a vacancy for three years. There's in China, Catholic bishops are under house arrest, Protestant pastors. In Tibet, there have been 118, 120 Tibetan monks who have poured kerosene on their bodies, lit a match, they burned themselves to death in protest. You have the Catholic Church being persecuted in Vietnam. The Buddhists are being persecuted in Vietnam. You look all over the world, and at this very time, America should be providing the leadership, and by pushing for religious freedom and having that opportunity, it means there's less need of a strong, not that we don't need a strong defense, we do, but if you recall during the 1980 to 1988, Reagan said, tear down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev. You can even see the picture of Reagan with Gorbachev at the Danilov Monastery, whereby Reagan is talking strong for religious freedom, and Gorbachev is there. You could do it in a way that changed the government. And if you remember President Reagan's funeral, Gorbachev came to President Reagan's funeral. So when America provides that leadership, there were no shots fired during Reagan's time with regard to communism. We brought it down by the Pope, who was pushing religious freedom, Pope John Paul in Poland and beyond. And so that, I think, is the reason that it's so important and we should be having. I personally believe that had the administration done something in 2009 when the so-called Green Revolution was taking place in Iran, they didn't say anything until that young girl was killed. I think there was an opportunity because from what I understand, we have a large Iranian population in my district there. They want freedom too, and they're looking for it. And we had an opportunity to topple that government at that time. So Reagan, I think, was the model, but not only Reagan. I think in fairness, Scoop Jackson, a Democratic senator, from Washington State, Tom Lantos, a Democratic congressman from California, and Henry Hyde. It was always a bipartisan thing, but America was always in the lead, and for some reason now, we are not in the lead.
We move to your questions. Tommy Liu is going to be our question enunciator. So thank you. And we'll do our best. We've got about 10 minutes for questions.
We have some very good questions here. Who in the current Congress is most capable of taking up this mantle of religious freedom, whether through public debate or actual legislation?
Well, you need to debate, but you need legislation. You need neither party has really embraced this at this moment. I would hope that the issue of religious freedom could be one of the major issues that every candidate running, whether Republican or Democrat, had to be able to articulate their understanding and some thought of what they were doing. You need great debate, but you need legislation. We need a domestic bill. So the people of faith, whatever faith, and As Christians, we are not, I'm speaking for myself, we are not to impose, we are to propose. God gives us freedom. Adam and Eve had freedom. They made a decision, and all through the Bible. So, but there must be a freedom, and it must be a freedom for a Buddhist to worship and be supportive of the Dalai Lama. It's against the law to have a picture of the Dalai Lama in Tibet. We should also advocate for the Baha'is. The Baha'is are being persecuted in Iran. We should advocate for the Ahmadi Muslims who are being persecuted in Pakistan. But I think debate, but we need some legislation and we need some leadership. And I would hope, I would love to see one of the debates, one of the presidential debates, focused on this issue of human rights and religious freedom. And lastly, to say something that needs to be said, as Christians, we should be condemning the anti-Semitism that's taking place around the world. There's growing anti-Semitism in Europe, in Germany, in France, but also on American college campuses. So I would like to see us debate, I'd like to see us pass something, but in order for that to come, now I don't think the Congress is going to do it unless there's pressure from outside.
Tolerance seems to be the order of the day in civil society. Does this idea help or hurt the cause of advancing religious liberty here in America?
You said tolerance?
Tolerance.
Well, tolerance is obviously good. I spoke to the chapel today, but tolerance ought not be the ultimate. It's almost becoming intolerant for a Christian to speak their mind. It's being intolerant. Jewish students on campuses are being shouted down. And so I think greater than tolerance is right and wrong and biblical truth. So tolerance is obviously good, but we should not worship tolerance, whereby tolerance means that a person of faith cannot articulate what their belief. Many people, again, Wilberforce, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, all have done what they did because of their faith. And Dr. Brantley, who I didn't go into detail, got Ebola in Sierra Leone because of his faith. And Dr. Brantley and Samaritan's Purse were ahead of CDC. So tolerance, but I don't think we should worship tolerance.
Congressman Wolf, what would you consider to be your greatest accomplishment from your time in Congress?
Being married to my wife for 53 years.
And, right, correct with, answer.
Without, let me tell you, without my wife, I will say this, but she knows I mean it. Without my wife, my wife. And my kids, but I've always said, and not to be critical of GEICO, but I was the claims adjuster at GEICO. If it hadn't been my wife, I'd be a second-rate claims adjuster at GEICO even today. So it's my wife.
We've had the privilege this week of being with Congressman Wolf and Carolyn, and I can tell you that we have been able to witness that partnership and that team in a unique way, and it really has been wonderful to see. Carolyn, we're so glad you're here. Beyond ISIS and the crisis in the Middle East, what do you believe is the biggest threat to religious freedom, and what regions of the world are most vulnerable?
Well, I think several. One, I think China, but yet on the other hand, the church is growing tremendously in China. I think the Middle East is probably the greatest. I think Iran wants to get a nuclear weapon. I think that probably in our lifetime we will see, and there'll always be a remnant, but we'll see the end of Christianity, unless something fairly is dramatically done, in Syria, and probably in Iraq, unless something is done. There is a saying out in the Middle East, that first the Saturday people, and then the Sunday people. The Saturday people, the Jewish community. The Sunday people, the Christian community. In 1950, the Jewish population of Iraq was 150,000. They're now down to four individuals. In 1950, the Jewish population of Egypt was 80,000. We were there last year, and we met with the leader of the Jewish community, and she said, there's 20 of us, more or less, and we're all over 60. So you have seen the end of the Jewish community for all practical purposes in Iraq and almost in Egypt. And I think that lastly, I think what takes place in our own country. I think the greatest threat, if we lose in a river city, and God can do anything he wants to do. But my sense is if we lose it here, and I think personally, our country, I think we're in trouble. Maybe it's because I've just gotten too old or we have too many grandkids and you go back. But if you look at where we are, I think we are approaching economic decline. We're not in decline. We are approaching it. And decline is a choice. It's not a destiny. We have $18 trillion of debt. We see things. I mean, you'll be able to go now next year to Washington, D.C., and you'll be able to buy your marijuana and smoke it and look at the Washington Monument, and then you'll be able to take the subway and go to the biggest gambling casino ever around, right across from the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. So I think it's what's happened here. That's why religious freedom, and we need what takes place in government is downstream from culture. And what takes place in culture is downstream from the pulpit. And one of the things that I said today at the chapel is that Alexis de Tocqueville said when he came to America, what he saw was amazing. He saw the pulpits aflame with righteousness. Frankly, I think a lot of this is going to depend on the church. So I think the greatest threat isn't from so much outside. It's right here in River City where we live.
And that's in keeping with this last question. It says, it speaks to what you were just saying. What can we do day to day in our communities to protect religious freedom, to promote it throughout Waco, regardless of our religious affiliation? What can we do?
Well, I think, one, we should do what Jesus tells us. We should love one another. You can have differences without, but we should not be embarrassed. There's a great, and again, I used it in the talk today at the chapel. We ought not be tame Christians. We ought not be cafeteria Christians. Cafeteria Christians sort of pick and choose. We want to be accepted by the beautiful people. We want to be accepted by the powerful people. We don't want to be viewed as retrograde or, you know, out of touch. And we are sometimes tame. If you even are hearing the modern message, it's the Christians are the oppressors. They're never the oppressed. The Christians are the persecutors. They're never the persecuted. Well, it's just the opposite. If imagine what America would be like without, imagine without a William Wilberforce, imagine without a Martin Luther King, imagine without a Dr. Brantley, imagine without a Mother Teresa, imagine without a Chuck Colson. So I think we should be bold, and it isn't, quite frankly, I'm not preaching a sermon, but it's whatever Jesus says, and it's Jesus. And I think we have to also, I think the millennials are looking for authenticity. They're looking for, and I think it's taking the message of Jesus into the marketplace and not backing down, not being reluctant to speak out. Be like Wilberforce. Be like Martin Luther King. Be like Dietrich Bonhoeffer. In a loving way. I mean, if Tony and I can sit together and come in at one vote the other way. But I think that is really But we should not be cafeteria Christians. And let me just say, everything I say tonight, and I'm not speaking to you, I'm really speaking to myself, because by saying it publicly, it helps me to hold myself accountable, nor should we be tame Christians. We should not be embarrassed of the message of Christ. We should not.
Before I call Dominic to the stage, Judge, do you have any closing remarks or any last questions?
That was a great closing remark, wasn't it? Isn't that beautiful? When we launched the Georgetown University and Baylor University partnership on religious freedom, we began collaborating in a number of respects. And early on in our collaboration, some of you have heard this, even a couple experienced it, we heard the voice of the leading Catholic patriarch of Iraq. His name is Louis Raphael Seiko, and he closed his remarks at a gathering at the Vatican in the shadows of, in the clouds of ISIS were gathering. And his message, I leave with you, if they kill all of us, will you care then? So my observations based on what you've shared this evening is, let's resolve really to educate ourselves. We need to be informed what's going on out there and not shield ourselves from it. Think of the parable of the Good Samaritan. Let's resolve to pray, to continue in prayer. And let's resolve to speak and not to remain silent. Obviously, some of you are called to support charitable activity. And we had one of our alums here, Billy Ray, who has a wonderful ministry in northern Iraq and continues to serve refugee families. And with his beautiful wife and beautiful children, he says, I'm not leaving. My wife and children may leave, but he's prepared to face the sword if ISIS comes, because he's going to be willing to stay and stand in harm's way and make the ultimate sacrifice. So there are these great stories around us. We need to educate ourselves, pray for them, and support them. But I think I've been moved to write Bill Flores, who's a very good man. This is not a political point. This is an issue that really needs to have the attention of our men and women in office in Washington, D.C.
Could I say two things? One, Bill Flores is a good congressman. Secondly, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and with Ken just saying it, said not to speak is to speak, and not to act is to act. So we have to speak and we have to act.
Thank you.
Wonderful. You've been listening to On Topic on 103.3 KWBU FM Waco. This conversation took place at the Baylor Club at McLean Stadium on Baylor University's campus.